overnight drove sales. We like eliminated all but a small percentage of those cart abandonments, and our revenue that year like tripled.
Hey everyone, I'm your host, Adam Leventer, and welcome to another episode of Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. A lot of us come from humble beginnings, but not all of us end up revolutionizing seafood distribution for the entire United States. That's why today I'm speaking with Chris Sherman, the CEO of Island Creek Oysters. Since 2009, Chris has transformed a local Duxbury oyster farm into a multi-million dollar operation, supplying world-renowned restaurants like the French Laundry and Per Se. But on top of all of that, Chris and the team began dominating the direct-to-consumer space in 2009 and never looked back. He's here now to talk about his scalable business systems and how he's democratizing access to premium seafood through e-commerce. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me. Psyched to be here.
How come you don't have that Boston Northeast accent?
It's a good question. My parents are from Connecticut, so they never really had it. My grandparents had it. But somehow, I don't know, skipped a generation. Or, I'm not sure.
Right.
I've been spared.
So parents are from Connecticut. The accent skips a generation. You've been growing up on the water for some time though, right? Take me back.
Yeah. So I grew up here. I was a water rat from an early age. So I used to work at a boatyard across the bay in Plymouth, Mass. And I take my boat to work every morning as like a 13-year-old, 14-year-old and go work the fuel dock. And I just got hooked at that point. I got really enamored with these boats, these big yachts and things would come in, or tuna fishing boats, and fuel up and go off into the ocean. And I was like, that needs to be me someday. So here I am. I've never really been able to get a job that didn't involve being on the ocean.
Yeah. And I read something, you've been working since you were what, 13 years old or something like that?
Well, yeah, I think my first job was at, ironically, at Skip, the founder and owner of Island Creek. His family had a general store. And that was my first job. I worked in like the beer cooler as like a 12-year-old stacking cases of beer. So yeah, full boomerang, came all the way back to my roots.
What's the seasonality or the seasonal nature of these businesses, at least in the area of the US where you are?
Yeah, it's a wild ride, honestly. I often fantasize about being in a business that's like consistent or even semi-consistent 12 months a year. There's the farming cycle, which is obviously very seasonal based around the life cycle of the oyster, where we have periods of high supply and really high quality, and then periods of lower supply, periods of lower quality. And then there's the consumer rhythm to it, which obviously a lot of people want to eat seafood in the summer. We have an outdoor restaurant here. A lot of our restaurants have patios and things like that, so they really pop in summer. January is pretty sleepy. So it's intensely seasonal, I guess is the short answer.
But you've been on Shopify since 2010. So I guess in some respects, you could look at D2C and e-commerce as a bit of a hedge to the seasonality. Is that how you see it?
It is. Not in so much as it's not seasonal, but it kind of marches to the beat of its own drum. So we have our week-to-week business kind of ticks along. Largely our business online, it's caviar and oysters and kind of high-end fish. So it's event-driven. So my assumption and some of the data we've collected over the years suggests that our week-to-week business is birthdays and dinner parties and things like that. But then we have these massive spikes around holidays, like Christmas is obviously huge, 4th of July, So it's not a steady business online, but it kind of runs on its own seasonality, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Island Creek has been around since something like 1995. And before you took over the business, you mentioned Skip. So this was Skip's business. How do you guys connect? How do you guys meet?
Yeah, great question. So in my water rat, young buck days, I ended up partnering with a good friend of mine through high school and college. And we had our own little wood refinishing business, and we would do power washing, and we'd do boats, and we'd do people's decks on their homes and things like that. It was called Partners in Grime Power Washing. Dirty decks done dirt cheap was our slogan. So it was pretty great. But in the beginning, it didn't really do that well. So we both had other jobs too. And my buddy, my partner, Alex Bezdek, he was one of Skip's first employees on the oyster farm. So we got to know Skip, and I frankly used to steal, he had a big ice machine. And so we would steal ice from their ice machine to like chill our beer on the weekends. So that's how I got to know
him. Okay. But fast forward, I mean, you developed this sort of more intense business relationship. Do you start working for Skip before you begin to discuss, I guess, partnership opportunities or things of that nature?
Yeah. So what happened was I went to college, and then I got into, in the kind of maritime world, I was a professional sailor, and I worked for yacht designers and built boats kind of all over the world, and eventually got to a place where two things happened. One, it was like 2008 recession, you know, that whole thing went down, and the super yacht industry was not in great shape. You know, the market was not doing well. So a lot of those people were pulling back. So it was hard to get those boat building gigs. And the other piece of it is that it got a little tired kind of moving all over the place. We were in New Zealand and the Caribbean and Maine. And so I was looking for a job that would keep me connected to the water, but in one place. And Skip had done all the heavy lifting, getting the farm off the ground, and they were getting some traction. They had a good name going for themselves, but there was still, you know, just a, I think we had between the farm and the little minute distribution company, I think there was maybe 5 or 6 employees when I started. And so I called Skip one day and I said, hey, I want to move back and I'm looking for a job. And I took a job working on the farm with an eye to helping out on the kind of sales marketing side of things as well. Skip's still very involved in the business. He runs all of the production, all of the growing of shellfish and everything like that. And we run everything together. So
what was the business model opportunity? Like when you came in and you take a look at the traditional business model that Island Creek was running at the time, did you have a sense of where the potential of this business was, or did this sort of evolve organically?
No, we had no idea. We sat around every year for a number of years, kind of pinching ourselves and saying, when is this oyster fad going to end? When's the bubble going to burst? Because the oysters were just a way to, you know, grow something on the bay. And it was really a lifestyle decision for all of us. But then they got really popular, and partly it was us. You know, we helped drive that with all the marketing that we were doing, and we were on the road for years and years doing events and things like that. So I like to think we helped kind of drive the oyster renaissance, as we call it. But now they've kind of become this ubiquitous product that people love, and they're served, and we sell to 46 states now. I mean, they're kind of everywhere. When I started, we just sold direct to a handful of restaurants in Boston. A couple of distributors here and there, and it was real small potatoes. So I guess to answer the question, no, I don't think any of us had any idea of how big the business would become, or frankly, the market and the demand for our core product.
Mm-hmm. So 46 states now, what's the split between B2C revenue versus B2B revenue?
We're still like 80% B2B and 20% D2C. That used to be more like 90-10 pre-pandemic, and then we grew a lot, and we've actually been able to quite remarkably retain almost all of our pandemic-driven growth in direct-to-consumer. So it's a stronger mix now.
So back in 2010, you guys stumble upon Shopify. So how did you come across the platform? What were you looking at, or what were you looking for at the time from an e-commerce partner?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we got into the direct-to-consumer business on a whim. You know, we were always looking for, you know, not that we had a lot of sophisticated strategy at that point, but we were innovative for sure. And we were always looking for the next kind of hustle that we could do. A lot of it driven by diversifying away from just being a farm, because there is some real cyclical pieces of that business. You have good years and bad years. And as we had more staff, you know, it became clear to us if we're going to create a stable business and be able to have people depend on us for a paycheck, we needed to be less volatile than just in the production agriculture business. So we did a bunch of things, but one of them was to start trying to sell oysters online. And quite frankly, we stood up this janky, I don't remember what the back end was. I think we built it ourselves in the first year that we did it. And I think we did like $6,500 in revenue the first year online. And that was probably $6,000 more than I thought we were going to do. our big question was, I just didn't think anyone was going to want to shuck oysters at home. I love oysters as much as anybody. And I'm a pro shucker at this point, but if I can get someone else to do it for me, I always do. So that was a big bump that we got over. So we actually got some traction after a couple of years running this janky homespun web store with a weird cart and all this stuff. We were looking for like a real solution, and we were lucky in that firms like Shopify and people like that were starting to kind of create a solution for people like us. And those are the two that we were evaluating, and Shopify was much more turnkey at the time. We didn't have developers or web production people or anything, so it had to be easy. And that's how we kind of made the choice. We kind of grew together.
Yeah, and Shopify, you know, I know their story very well as a Canadian based here, certainly have watched that company's rise. And they too, I mean, in some respects, they too were just trying to figure it out to try and serve merchants better. But kudos to you for sticking with it. Can you just walk us through your e-commerce journey, like those first few years? What were the challenges? What were the different aspects that you're running into that, you know, became sort of barriers to building digital?
Yeah, there's a couple of kind of watershed moments. One, in the early stages, when we first switched to Shopify, we all of a sudden had access to some analytics, which we hadn't had previously. We were just guessing and pulling the strangest data from our cart and things like that. And one of the things we saw right out of the gate, like literally the first week we were using Shopify, is that we had a high cart abandonment rate. And our assumption then was, okay, like everyone's willing to pay really whatever to get premium oysters shipped to them in Chicago or Denver or wherever they may be. But people get to the cart and then they see the shipping is pretty significant as a percentage of the cost, even though we had really competitive FedEx rates from our direct-to-chef business. And we just made the simple decision to say, okay, we're going to, and this was not nearly as standard practice at the time, but we just embedded shipping into the cost and kind of worked out a number that hedged against shipping to California versus shipping ground to someone in Mass. And that overnight drove sale. We like eliminated all but a small percentage of those cart abandonments, and our revenue that year like tripled. And so that was a big kind of learning experience for us. And we retain that model today. We still ship the vast majority of SKUs on our website go out free shipping. So, which is a big thing for people when you're buying fresh seafood.
I would assume loyalty is a big aspect of your business, like repeat purchase rate, repeat customers. Is this a segment of the data that you pay attention to?
For sure. Yeah, we have a astoundingly high, you know, return customer rate. And, you know, that obviously blends into looking at the lifetime value of those customers, and it informs our kind of marketing strategy around acquisition. So we know we can spend a fair amount of money to acquire a customer because it is extremely likely that they're going to order again. So we're not just looking at it on that one order basis. And I know that's pretty boilerplate for people in direct to consumer, but you know, for us, it's been that learning curve because we're a seafood company first and foremost, and we are obviously majority B2B. So we've always been doing a little bit of wheel reinvention as opposed to somebody who does a startup that's purely online direct to consumer. So that was a big revelation for us for sure.
So from a marketing strategy standpoint, and for those that are paying attention to these metrics, lifetime value, customer acquisition cost, if you're comfortable sharing, what ratios are healthy for your business? Is there a threshold with respect to LTV to CAC that you want to hit in terms of deploying marketing dollars? Like, what does the marketing strategy look like behind the scenes?
Yeah, it's a good question. And frankly, you know, candidly, I'm not as involved with it day to day as I used to be. We have a team now, and we have a digital agency that we work with to really optimize that stuff. However, I can tell you that like 60% of our online business is from repeat customers. So it's a significant share. Our average order is something like $150. So when we go out and think about acquisition costs, you know, we've got, you know, $20 to play with as far as looking at paid digital specifically to get a new customer into the system. And there's obviously times of the year where that becomes much easier. We really focus spend around, you know, the holidays and things like that. It's a little harder of a pitch to get someone to kind of click through online on an average week in August or something. And then the other piece of it, we have a lot of organic flow through to the site as well, because we are out in the world with doing restaurants and brick and mortar retail. And we do a lot of content marketing for the brand in general, which thankfully we have a really good, loyal kind of fan base. And so we get some flow through that's not, we're not just a strictly kind of digital acquisition strategy, which is really nice. But that the kind of organic boots on the ground marketing is not cheap either. So it's always a push and pull between those two things.
Yeah. And I've heard you talk about this previously, this idea of analog marketing or old school marketing. Events, food festivals, et cetera, probably super important in your world. But is it 50-50 at this point? Like, are you looking at analog marketing as kind of 50% of the overall marketing strategy? Is it bigger than that?
It depends on how you slice it, right? Because there's, you can look at the spend, right, and what you're spending on digital as a comparison. And, you know, I think the temptation for a lot of people as it relates to analog marketing is to try to apply the same metrics to that analog marketing as you would to digital, because digital is so measurable, it's so transparent, it's right there, and you just can't, you know, because we tried everything over the years. We tried to do codes that we pass out in events or codes for radio ads and things like that. And people use the codes, some people don't use the codes. Maybe they come back around, you know, 6 months later and there's a recognition there. And that's obviously, you know, Meta and the other, and Google and the other digital advertising platforms all capitalize on that as well. They know that it's not just a one, you know, you see it once and you click, you buy, but you have to really look at it holistically. And when we think about the blend, you know, we don't spend a lot at this point on like traditional advertising in comparison to our digital. We don't spend a lot on, we spend far less now on doing events and traveling and things like that. However, what we do spend a lot on is we have in-house creative and marketing, and we do a lot of content marketing that is not necessarily paid. You know, we're just putting organic content out, whether it's videos, online, social. We have a really robust Instagram following. We have a big email database. So we're looking at that really as a funnel. And what I would say is that on the analog marketing, that kind of funnel-based approach is much more applicable, because you do kind of start the journey at a much earlier level. And it's not all about getting, you know, your conversion from day one. You know, it's about kind of drawing them in and getting them to sign up for email. And once they're on email, we know we have such and such likelihood that they'll convert. So that is a lot more of a holistic approach. Whereas with digital, like I said, because we have such strong analog marketing, we don't have a huge funnel. Like when we're doing digital, we're really looking for conversion. Because we feel like we deploy enough resources with our organic content and people who are visiting our locations and things like that, at that high level funnel. And that seems to be more effective to kind of start people on that journey than just seeing a display ad that's really more about, oh, like, check us out. Here's just some information about our business, or sign up for email. We have less traction with that in digital.
When you think about your content marketing strategy in the world of Oysters, like, what types of content are you putting out there that people feel is entertaining? Is it like how to shuck oysters? What wines to pair with oysters? What to eat with oysters? Like, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a variety. And I think from an early stage, we've always kind of thought of ourselves as a lifestyle brand. And that again, now 15 years later is less of a rarity. But even in our business, I think you see lifestyle brands in apparel and homewares and things like that. You don't see a lot of food companies that are producing and marketing food high up in the value chain taking that approach. And so that's been most successful for us, is creating a scene and allowing people to kind of put themselves in that moment, which lets them understand how to incorporate the product into their life or their aspirational life. You know, that's a big piece of it. We're like, we go out on the boat, we've got tin fish, we've got oysters, whatever, we do the spread. You can take a camping, you can go into a high-end restaurant. The brand we've intentionally kept very versatile for that reason, is we can kind of reach people where they're at and where they see themselves kind of partaking in our product and in that lifestyle, no matter who they are or what they're doing. So that's been our most successful content over the years. That being said, we have really great engagement on some of the more basic stuff, like how to shuck and how to assemble a tin board. The how-tos are great. And then we have other things that are just janky, and we're all a little weird here. So some of that content hits and some of the weird stuff doesn't, but when it hits, it hits well.
When you think about Island Creek as a lifestyle brand, do you have other brand pillars? Like, is there an overarching brand strategy that you have somewhere, say on a whiteboard at the company?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for us, it has evolved quite a bit over the years, I would say. But at this point, we have a few different product categories. We've got tin fish, we've got caviar, we've got oysters. And we have a few different iterations of our hospitality locations where those things are really brought to life by talented chefs and in beautiful venues. And what we've arrived at is there is this kind of incredible global coastal lifestyle that we really try to tap into that is about living well, enjoying the ocean, appreciating it, taking care of it, eating responsibly, but eating well and living well as a result. And that is as much about wine and food as is about, you know, how you're spending your time. It's sailing, it's fishing, it's whatever, but it really seems to resonate people in a way that's far, far bigger than us. So for a long time, we were on the hunt to say, all right, what else can we tap into here that's bigger than us to get some momentum? That's not just this is Island Creek and we're appealing for the following reasons. It's like, this is Island Creek and be part of this aspirational lifestyle that you're pursuing. And that's been really effective.
What does that mean from a category expansion standpoint? Like, you are in a niche category, let's say, but you are into tin fish, caviar. There are ancillary sort of venues or spaces where you could bring this lifestyle brand to life, as you mentioned, through these local venues or what have you. But as you think about category expansion, which historically has been somewhat of a challenge for some brands or some product-related brands in the past, how do you think about it?
I'd start by saying it's a challenge for us, for sure, both from a adoption standpoint of getting our existing customers to, you know, adopt new product categories at a critical mass. And then it's also a challenge just from a core value standpoint for the business. We're all here because we're passionate about oysters, because oysters have a lot of these intrinsic qualities where they're traceable, they're good for the environment, they're generally grown by small mom and pop farms. There's a lot going for them. And from a seafood standpoint, it's kind of a fraught industry, right? It's like there's a lot of fraud, there's traceability issues, there's slave labor, there's environmental concerns. And we've always kind of been very luckily and by happenstance in this ivory tower of our core product has these intrinsic values that kind of hacks around a lot of those concerns that people rightly have with seafood. So as we look to expand, we're trying to find products that not only appeal to our customers and fit into that vision of the Island Creek kind of coastal lifestyle, but also ones that can kind of measure up in the face of the values that we and our team feel really strongly about when we go to source product. And one of the ways we've gotten around that is we've really tried to, with the new categories we're in, vertically integrate as much as we possibly can. That way we get around these kind of globe-spanning supply chains where you don't know what's happening or who's doing what. If we own as much of the production as we possibly can, then we know because we're doing it ourselves. So that's why we've built a cannery down in New Bedford to do the tin fish. We do all of our own caviar packing in-house. We touch, hold, and own the product as much as we possibly can, which is pretty rare these days. So those are the kind of like core fundamental elements. And then beyond that, from a kind of more traditional consumer marketing perspective, we're looking for products that complement that lifestyle. They're flavorful and abundant, and like, and it's a rich experience, for one. And then two, there are things that you can take with you into a number of different contexts. It's not just something you're eating at a dinner party or, you know, at a high-end restaurant or something. They're versatile. So we've gone more and more towards things that are shelf stable, like the tin fish. The caviar has got a much longer shelf life than the oysters do. And then there's sustainability is a big component of it too in the consumer context. So we look for things that have intrinsic qualities, like the tin fish can be shipped, not air freight. It can go ground, which is huge for seafood. And it's still this incredible high quality seafood that you're getting. So those are things we're looking for. And we've gotten a lot of great traction with the two kind of bolt-on categories that we've got. It's taken years. Like we've been in the caviar business for, I think, 7 years now. And it's becoming a really significant share of our overall business, and particularly so online for direct-to-consumer. And then tins are coming right up behind it.
let's double click on the direct to consumer for a moment, but on the logistics side of things. So you mentioned the idea of shelf stable being a critical piece here. So correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys now do overnight delivery anywhere in the United States. And that model, I think you've described it as sort of the flower delivery model, if you will, where it's analogous to that. I would imagine that if we were rolling back to 2010, 2011, 2012, you probably weren't doing overnight anywhere in the country, at least. So just talk to me about the evolution of the supply chain and the D2C logistics of this whole business.
Yeah, so that's still evolving for us for sure. It's a constant, you know, we're logistics is a major core competency of what we do. And for any seafood company, it's a big piece of it. So it's an ever evolving component. We benefit from the fact that because we took a little bit of an innovative approach to our distribution, whereas traditionally a producer in the B2B channel would sell to distributor, who then probably sells to another distributor who then hits a hotel or a restaurant. And that's a chain that works. It's mostly done via trucks and, you know, it has a lot going for it. But because our demand outstripped our supply for so long, we chose to, after we had gotten traction going direct in cities like Boston and New York, we chose to start trying to do overnight delivery via air freight or FedEx for our B2B customers. And we got a lot of traction with it. And that gave us the critical mass on FedEx to have a reasonable discount that we could apply also to the direct-to-consumer channel. And so that was the major stepping stone to getting into that overnight delivery schema that has really paid spades. So that's really the crux of it right now. There's some corollaries to that. There's different markets we serve a little bit differently. But for the most part, we're hitting overnight on FedEx.
Has there been an evolution on the FedEx side with their comfort level with a product like this? Like, oysters, you know, I would assume have an incredibly short shelf life and you've got to ship fresh. It's got to be timely. They are a core piece of this whole logistics puzzle and a core partner of yours. So have they always been comfortable with being a partner in this space?
That's a great question. They have and they haven't. You know, we've had our ups and downs over the years for sure. It's worth pointing out that they do, obviously it's a fresh product and the maintaining a cold temperature is critical because they're consumed raw and you need to keep them safe. So that's a big piece of it. However, as opposed to say shipping fresh fish or even fresh meat for that matter, oysters are actually alive when we're shipping them. So the shelf life is actually pretty good. You can eat an oyster, you know, at certain times of the year, they can be in your fridge or, you know, under refrigeration for 3 weeks and they're still in fine shape. So we have a little bit more time to play with, but people are picky about dates. And then the other piece of it is the core challenge is maintaining that temperature in the packaging. So that's really the primary driver for why everything really goes overnight, is so that we can make sure that product is staying below 45 degrees for its entire journey. Once we get into 2 or 3 days, you know, it's a little more questionable. We have monitoring in each package to make sure that when the end user gets it, they can check to make sure that temperature has been maintained. But then we start getting scenarios we're looking at using dry ice and other things, and you can't on FedEx. So we've very much played in FedEx box on that. And a lot of that has driven us to overnight. And they've been good partners over the years for sure. You know, ups and downs during the pandemic, but and it's at peak volume, like around Christmas, now that more and more direct-to-consumer brands are trying to, whether they're shipping apparel or toys or whatnot, they're all trying to ship overnight around Christmas. We're a 52-week a year overnight shipper, so we try to, they've given us priority, which is good. So a lot of good there, but definitely some challenges as well.
Do you feel like there's an element of cool factor or the sort of the water cooler effect with respect to buying oysters online that benefits you as a brand? So if I'm a consumer, it's a lot cooler to talk to my friends about how I bought my oysters from Island Creek and they were shipped to my house than it is for me to say I got it from a local grocer, right? There's this element of cool. There's this element of word of mouth that I would assume happens in your space.
No doubt. Yeah. A, it is cooler to do it that way. I think always buying direct from the producer whenever it's feasible is best case. And a lot of times we're getting fresher product, you know, because like if you're buying whatever fish, you know, tuna or oysters, and they're sitting in a case at a fish market or a grocery store, you know, chances are when you're getting them direct, they're going to be fresher, you know, for whatever that's worth. Like I said, the shelf life is pretty strong, but by the same token, why not give yourself all the shelf life that you can get so you can get 50 oysters and work off of them over the course of a week or so rather than going to the store, picking up a dozen, having to eat them that night. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And then I think the cool factor is for sure a thing. Like I always joke about, I like to think that a lot of our consumers online in particular are getting the oysters. And then I know during the holidays and things, they're bringing them over to as a gift or to a party, you know, and my story is always like showing up at the party. I always bring oysters, obviously, because I don't get right. People don't invite me to places if I don't bring oysters and caviar, I've realized.
So, there you go. There's your value.
Yeah. And everyone else shows up with like a bottle of wine with a ribbon on it or whatever. And like they pile up on the counter. But you show up with the oysters, you start shucking them over the sink. Immediately, everyone's there.
It's a conversation piece, right?
It's a conversation starter. They bring people together in a way that very few things do. And then you always get invited back. So I think it's kind of a no-brainer in that way.
That's so funny. Let's rewind back to something you said earlier on in the episode, which is when you joined, I think there was something 5 employees. Fast forward, I think you guys are at 120 at this point, which is exceptional growth, right? Congrats on everything you've been able to build there. What have you learned along the way?
Oh, so much. Yeah, we're at 120 heads now, kind of full-time year-round. And I think we're about 320 seasonally, like through the warmer months of the year here in New England. So certainly it's a far different animal, you know, from an organizational management standpoint than it was when we were 5 or even 50. So yeah, I think learning about people has been a huge component of it. We always had a really strong team culture. No one's coming to work here to get rich. You know, it's like this is a passion play for almost all of our staff. It's like if you want to get rich, you can go be a banker or a lawyer or any number of different things. Working for an oyster farm is not it. However, people have done fairly well here. We try to make good on that. But I think we really have to honor the fact that people are here for a reason. And that is a privilege for us as the people running the business. And it's something that we really try to make good on. So we've had our ups and downs over the year with that, growing pains as far as how do we cultivate that type of culture that we did with 30 people when we could all go away and go for a ski trip for the weekend or whatever and celebrate a great year. How do we do that with 300 people and kind of maintain that same vibe? So I would say on the scale front, all the operational challenges and things like that, that's the easy part. The real growth, both personally and professionally, has been on creating an environment where 300 people want to come to work every day and can leave feeling like they did something that was worthwhile with their time.
Did you see yourself as a culture builder? I mean, you're the CEO of the company now, but as you've grown the company, looking back, do you think that you had a gift for building and or fostering a really healthy environment?
I don't know about that. I think Skip and I both are people who have a commitment that we don't want to come to work every day with a group of people that don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's always been a core prerequisite for how we want to run the business is we want to work with people who are, you know, fun to be around and psyched to do what we're doing and understand the mission. So I think a lot of it was really by default or by accident, but it just bore from Skip's motivations and mine. Which we always say is you spend 80% of your adult life doing your job. So why not do a job that, you know, you actually like doing and with a group of people who you like doing it with? And obviously we have huge challenges and everyone works so hard here. You know, there's an image I think we get with like when we're interviewing new staff where like we're all running around in flip-flops and drinking daiquiris all day. And we do some of that.
That does happen. Okay.
But there's like a deep, deep grind that happens too around, you know, fulfillment in these peak seasons and things like that and the farming and like, it's really hard work. So we've just been lucky in a lot of ways that we've tried to run a business where we would want to work. And that's kind of translated pretty effectively for other people. And it's not a great fit for everybody. You know, that's the other thing that we realized over the years is that it's just not for everybody, you know? So our job is to find the people, you know, for whom it is for.
So you guys have a relationship with Thomas Keller's restaurants or sister restaurants. The French Laundry is one name that people will recognize. Very famous Napa Valley spot. And also this place called, is it Per Se in New York?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the relationship with these restaurants? And I assume you're supplying oysters to these folks, but how did this all begin?
It's been a huge piece of our success. And we have incredible gratitude for Thomas Keller and their group. They've been really great to us over the years. I like to think that we've been good to them as well. But it really came about accidentally. The French Laundry out in Napa got incredible traction early on in its kind of tenure as one of the world's best restaurants and has maintained that. And they do such an incredible job. And Thomas opened Per Se, which is their New York location, related to the French Laundry, another Michelin-starred fine dining restaurant in Columbus Circle. And when they did, they were just about to open and they had a fire in the kitchen. And so what they did, rather than kind of furlough everybody, is they sent their kitchen staff out and they said, go find us great product, because great product is a prerequisite for great food. And there was a chef, Chris Lamadou, who's since passed away, who's a kind of major person in the Island Creek Hall of Fame, that Skip knew from, we were doing sales out in Nantucket, and he got to know him. And Chris came to Island Creek, and we had these small little oysters that we call runts. They're a fully mature, beautiful oyster, but they're just small. But they have this deep cup with a big belly in them. And Chris stumbled upon these oysters, said, these are awesome. And so he took it back to Thomas, and they started working with the product, and they developed a dish that's basically, they cut out the two bellies of the oysters with surgical scissors. They blanch them in champagne and do some other culinary hocus pocus that's above my kitchen pay grade. And they put them on a bed of Sabayon tapioca pearls with a big hunk of caviar next to it. And it's an incredible dish. And it comes out, they serve it on like, there's like 18 dishes. And then at the middle of it is this beautiful little oysters and pearls. And every dish at French Laundry and Per Se changes just about every night, you know, the new tasting menu. But that dish, and our oysters are one of the few things that have stayed on the menu every day since Per Se opened, and then very shortly thereafter at French Laundry as well. And it's really became one of their signature dishes. So we've been really fortunate to benefit from that relationship. And we sell them oysters at both those locations, Bouchon's, all over the country. And it's been really just fantastic. And we're really grateful for it.
Well, I hope you get front of the line privileges when you go to those places.
We get some good privileges at the restaurants that we sell to. That's definitely a perk of the job.
For sure. Chris, just before we go, so this idea of being at the forefront of aquaculture, yeah, how do you stay on top of the trends and lead the industry on a go-forward basis?
Yeah, it's a big question. A few different ways. So aquaculture has always been core to who we are and what we do. It's farming the ocean, essentially, and there's good ways to do it and bad ways to do it. So for us, we're always focusing on not only how do we get better at aquaculture, huge emphasis right now on quality of our product and trying to make sure that as we scale, we maintain that original, fantastic Island Creek quality. We're lucky because Duxbury Bay does a lot of the heavy lifting, but there's a big impetus on us. So that's a big piece of it. But the other thing is, you know, the rising tide floats all the boats, and there's been a tremendous growth in the number of shellfish farms on the East Coast since we started, literally thousands more farms. And so we've tried to figure out ways that rather than just competing against those folks, we can work with them. So we distribute oysters for a couple hundred of those farms under their own brand. We market them and their staff, and we put pictures up online. You know, we have a hatchery, we grow shellfish seed, we sell seed to those growers. So that's been a big piece of it. And also looking at coastal communities and our positive impact there. The move to New Bedford with our cannery was really poignant on that front. It's the largest value fishing port in the United States and a huge center for seafood innovation. So being in the mix there is really important. And then we do science to validate some of the long-held assumptions we've had as an industry about the ecological benefits of shellfish farming. We partner up with organizations like the Nature Conservancy and Woods Hole Oceanographic and MIT to get a better kind of data-based picture of what our farms are doing in the environment, in the communities where they're located. So that's been a big component of it too. And then obviously the new product categories, I think, and fleshing out the you know, the good vibes around Oyster is like, what else can we add to that? How do we better serve our customers and stay ahead of these trends or stay on top of them?
All right, man, this has been a real pleasure. Well, all the best to you and Skip, and best of luck in your next chapter.
Adam, can't thank you enough for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
That's Chris Sherman, CEO of Island Creek Oysters, and this is Shopify Masters. Our show is produced by Gogo Zoger and Megan Coyle. Our engineers are Matt Schwartz and Miku Betlem. Benjamin Gottlieb is our managing producer, and I'm your host, Adam Levinter. Be sure to tune in every Tuesday and Thursday for brand new episodes. And if you haven't already, go check out our new YouTube channel and be sure to subscribe. Thanks.